This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. John Balaban went to Vietnam in 1967 not to fight in the war there, but to work as a conscientious objector. In fact, he was one of the few American civilians who volunteered to spend time in that war-torn country. He worked as a teacher and relief worker, evacuating war-injured Vietnamese children to the U.S. for medical treatment. While there, he also collected and translated Vietnamese poetry. John Balaban has written a book about those years in Vietnam called Remembering Heaven's Face. He went there, sure in his belief that war, that war, was wrong. But he writes that as the war continued, my conscientious objection seemed like such vain posturing. I was the merest spectator, a proverbial cricket that might be crushed where tigers and elephants fight. John Balaban is now a professor of English and director of the MFA writing program at Pennsylvania State University. He also has a new book of poetry called Words for My Daughter. Though John Balaban went to Vietnam with the intention of helping, the Vietnamese people didn't make a distinction between him and the other Americans who had come there to fight a war.
I was pretty young and foolish, and I thought going off all the high-minded purpose that carried me to Vietnam was just sort of shining from me like an emblem. But, you know, to the Vietnamese, I just looked like any other of the 500,000 Americans who were there. And very quickly, I felt very small and out of it. I mean, I wasn't a soldier, so I didn't have a very sensible place in the scheme of operations in Vietnam. I wasn't a government official. I was supposed to be a teacher of linguistics at a university in the Mekong Delta, but I never even got to do that because the place got bombed during Tet. So I really stayed in an interesting inner space between Vietnamese and Americans. I had Vietnamese friends. I finally learned Vietnamese. I traveled alone on buses in the countryside. I did things that Americans could not do, so I saw the war in a different way.
The way you write about the war and even about Vietnam itself and how it acclimated itself to the war was that it was so full of contradictions and paradoxes and things that didn't make sense. You write about talking to, I believe it was an American soldier who had as a kind of trophy or emblem, an ear, and at the same time you saw someone walk away with a book of poetry in their back pocket.
Even closer, I mean, it was a Navy medic I went to for heat rash, and he showed me like the way boys show each other their pet frogs. He had this human ear in a jar of formaldehyde, and he was just sort of grinning about it, much the way kids with, you know, pets like that do. And I was kind of horrified. But his superior, the doctor in charge of the clinic, I remember actually the passage you described. He had in his hip pocket a book of Gerard Manley Hopkins poetry. And there are so many contradictions. I think pretty soon my high-minded morality had to take a few hits. I mean, my best friend turned out to be a CIA agent. I was set down in Khao Lan, in a very insecure province near the Cambodian border. And really the most moral, most fun, and certainly the most interesting person, because he got to make all these very secret trips, et cetera, that I tagged along on, was the CIA agent, who actually ended up opposed to the war.
Well, as many of your conversations, although you had disagreements, there were a number of things that you agreed on about the war, and yet he was there as a member of the CIA, a member of the government.
He was very proud. He had spent a life in the agency, and he's particularly proud of putting down the communist insurgency, doing some stint in Greece after World War II. He said it made him feel good. He said, sure, we killed some bad guys, he said, but they usually had guns in their hands. And he said, it wasn't like this, John. And he wasn't proud of what he was doing there.
And teaching linguistics, did that make sense in that context?
It made no sense. It was absurd. All I finally realized I was doing was keeping a Vietnamese linguistics teacher out of the classroom that I was taking up and putting him on a battlefield. It made no sense at all. But lots of things like that got solved for me. The university was bombed flat, and I had to find another job, and that's when I went to work for the Committee of Responsibility to save war-burned and war-injured children.
You also describe, in talking about these war-injured children, working in a hospital, actually, right during the Tet offensive.
Right.
Actually, this was before working with the children, but you were at a hospital there and had to defend it against, I guess it would be the Viet Cong.
Yeah. This, of course, posed a problem for me since I was a conscientious objector to taking of human life and refused to join the military, although I was doing alternative service in Vietnam. But The offensive was going on, and in fact, it was going on in various parts of the city. One of our houses fell. We had to move to another place one night. But we went to the hospital, the province hospital, where there was an American surgical team helping the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese didn't show up at all. There were no nurses, no doctors. And when we got there, there were a group of Air Force surgeons leaving, looking very worried, because there were Cobra helicopters directly overhead letting loose their rockets, and the place was a sea of injured people lying in the courtyards, and no one taking care of them. No anesthesia, no x-ray, no doctors, I think even no running water at that point.
And these were all Vietnamese?
These were all Vietnamese civilians, and I had never seen anything like it, and all my anti-war rhetoric seemed pretty hollow at that point, and I really grasped what the war meant. We said, "Where are you going?" And they said, "Well, we can't stay here. There were supposed to be Viet Cong on the grounds." And they said, "We'll stay here and operate if you'll guard for us." And this presented a real problem, but we did. I was given a grease gun. It's a real crude, slow submachine gun. Somebody had a carbine, and someone was given a 45 pistol. There were three of us in the same voluntary group.
Had you ever picked up a gun before?
Oh, yeah. I was, as a kid, I liked them. You know, I hunted with my father and brother. It's, you know, it was the idea of shooting people that bothered me, and I didn't want to do that. And but I did, and it seemed to me that whatever my scruples about killing Viet Cong, there was this large number of innocent civilians that certainly were going to perish. Maybe would have anyway, but they had no chance if the doctors left.
So where did you stand guard?
Well, with a friend in this International Voluntary Services, Roger Hinsey, he's another 22-year-old like I was, we walked the grounds to see if the Viet Cong were there because we thought it would be better to chase them out rather than being sitting and getting shot ourselves. And we found no one, so we just hung around the operating room, each took a corner. And then, to our great relief, later in the day, the Green Berets arrived, and they took up positions and properly, you know, scoured the hospital grounds and said the place was too unsafe and so we had to get out of there.
Have you thought about if you had had the opportunity, would you have shot someone to defend a civilian?
I guess. You know, at some point, you don't want to die yourself. And if you're carrying a gun around, you better use it. I mean, I felt ashamed. I felt like I had left my ideals of conscientious objection very much in the lurch. But on the other hand, it was a real dilemma.
You write that you were as frightened of the Viet Cong as you were of the South Vietnamese army.
More of the South Vietnamese. The Viet Cong were predictable. Mm-hmm. They'd kill for purpose that one could understand. But the South Vietnamese were unpredictable. They would loot. They looted our house the next night, and I don't think it would have gone well for us if we were in there. They were unreliable allies, as many soldiers have testified. So I was as frightened of them as anybody.
There was a person, Dave Gittleson,
a good friend
of yours, who was killed under, I guess we could say, mysterious
circumstances. Gittleson was a mysterious person completely. I mean, I've learned a lot about him in many years since he died. But he was murdered. He was murdered about 2 weeks after he gave information on a massacre of civilians to Edward Kennedy, who was then heading a Senate committee of the judiciary to examine refugees and civilian casualties. At the moment, his brother, Robert, was still alive and looked like the certainty for the presidential race. So Gittleson gave this information to Kennedy, went back to this remote province that he lived in as an agricultural worker, was found dead a couple weeks later.
You went to get his body?
I went to get his body, and that was, you know, hard to do. He was a very special person. He lived out there by himself, you know, wearing flip-flops and cutaway blue jeans. He was, you know, always carrying pigs for farmers to raffle. He had these mimeograph tips for farmers on how to fertilize. He was always trying to figure out what diseases were on their fruit trees and things like that. And he was certainly, of all the Americans I knew, the most far out into the Vietnamese. Oddly enough, he also had safe passes from the Viet Cong, something I learned about after his death as well. But he was not liked by the American officials, and now the best guess is that he was killed either by Vietnamese with a wink from the Americans or perhaps even in the Phoenix program itself. That's one theory that a journalist out in California has who's interviewed various people that knew around the death.
What did his death mean to you? Because here was someone who wasn't a soldier who was killed.
That merely being a nice guy and wishing people well wasn't going to be enough to keep me alive if I stayed in Vietnam. And shortly after that, I did carry a gun. I got a .38, which I don't think even the people I lived with knew I had it. I was ashamed of it. After all, I still thought of myself as a CO. But I kept it in my briefcase and carried it. I just didn't want to die like Gittleson did. He was shot close up, probably by people he knew, if you can judge by the way the bullets hit him.
Which was what, straight on?
Straight on, right through his hands. At the end, he held his hands up to ward off the shooting.
Well, you write, "What wrenches my heart as I sit in my attic and sift through notebooks and memories now 20 years old is the thought of my odd, brainy, compassionate friend's last seconds as the bullet sliced through his outstretched hands and his eyes before closing glimpsed an enormity of evil larger than any of us imagined."
Yeah, none of us figured Americans would kill Americans. We didn't think it was that bad or that cynical. But we were growing up in Vietnam.
My guest is writer John Balaban. His new book, Remembering Heaven's Face, is about his experiences as a conscientious objector in Vietnam during the war. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer John Balaban. You mentioned earlier about the fact that you were helping to get some of these war-injured children out of Vietnam, and that this work really energized you. You write about not being able to sleep at night and feeling this kind of intensity about your mission. Was it the fact that you felt that you could actually do something for people, as opposed to, not that linguistics is unimportant, but somehow in the face of war?
Well, yeah. When I went to work for this committee, I could do something very real. I thought teaching linguistics finally was a waste of time. But saving war-injured children's lives seemed to me a perfectly good use of my time and good service. And so I did this with another field representative. It was awful. We had to go through so many levels. First, there was a Vietnamese medical examining commission that had approved the child. That was hard enough to get through. And then we had to send for each child papers to the Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Interior, the National Police, the American Embassy. There were some forms that we had to do in 9 copies, some in 35 copies each.
And this is a probably Xerox days?
Pre-Xerox. It was all done with, you know, that blue stuff. I don't even know what you call it anymore. Yeah. Carbon paper. And then in the ministries themselves, since we weren't paying bribes, it was hard making any movement at all. Can I read a passage?
Yes, you can. Okay. Sure.
It'll give you an idea. "One oppressively hot afternoon in the Ministry of Interior, as the hair and skin of my arm shone with sweat, my white shirt spattered with tar from the scooter ride through town, my eyes rimmed with exhaust suit, my hair matted to my forehead, I remember thinking I would strangle the next bureaucrat, man or woman, who looked at some child's papers, sucked their teeth, and said, 'Cum duck, no good,' without even looking up from the desk. My particular problem that day was a bespectacled little man who had been trained, like most South Vietnamese officials, in the French civil service. I really thought of hitting him, if not strangling him, but of course that was a luxury I couldn't afford. The child whose papers he wouldn't accept had been burned by a white phosphorus artillery shell. Her scalp was bare and burned in patches, her eyelids were partially burned off, and her chin was glued to her neck, permanently yanking down her lower lip and exposing her teeth. Suddenly I had a bright idea. I reached into my briefcase, took out the girl's photos, and without saying a word, put them on the desk in front of the man, who had continued to look down at his other papers in the hope I'd go away. For a moment, the man looked at the two photos, front and side, then he gathered them back up, handed them to me, and perhaps for the first time in our dealings, really looked at me. His face was a mixture of grief, shame, and nausea. 'It's awful,' I said, almost feeling guilty for what I'd done to him. 'Maman,' he said in French, taking back my papers and stamping them approved."
You also write about the fact that taking these children away from their families and from what you describe as a vibrant tangle of love and obligation wasn't necessarily a simple act to do. On paper, yes, getting children to hospitals where they can be cared for seems like a straightforward, simple, good thing to do.
It does. But we worried about it later because we had strange reports coming back. These children, like this girl, weren't simple cases. They required years of plastic and reconstructive surgeries. sometimes as long as 5 years. Imagine taking a child away for 5 years to America. The Vietnamese peasants largely wouldn't have even considered this if they didn't know that their child would have died, remained disfigured, or died a slow, horrible death in Vietnam. So as their only bet to save their child's life, and we had to promise, and we're legally bound to return those children, and we did.
Who took care of them here? Did you find families?
Wonderful families, foster families that the committee found who took care of them while the children were convalescing, sometimes even put them into schools. A few children stayed, the ones who were actually orphans, and we knew they were orphans. But the rest, I and other volunteers in the committee responsibility took home.
How many children were you actually able to help? Would you
say? So few. We brought 88 to the United States. I would guess maybe we helped 1,000 or more in Vietnam itself because we took children to Saigon where there were some better hospitals. There was a Japanese hand surgery team at Charé Hospital. There was a British pediatric team at Needham, the children's hospital. And then the Americans built a private plastic burns unit. So, you know, 100 and then 100. I mean, it's so few when you... There were approximately 100,000 civilians killed every year of the war, more children than any other group. You know, we did very little, actually.
I was wondering, when you came back from that war, whether you identified with the soldiers who had fought there or whether you identified with the people who were protesting that war stateside.
Neither. I found myself separated from both. You know, I've shared the sentiments of the war protesters, but... The rhetoric was burdensome to me.
Did they seem naive?
Yeah, they seemed to be angry, but they didn't seem... Well, I don't know. I shouldn't say it, because really I missed a lot of the protest. I was in Vietnam. I'm really talking about the way it was before 1967 when I went. There's a lot of what happened in the U.S. that I wasn't even aware of. Books that came out, Newsweek articles, you know, music I just missed completely. Gradually, I began to see myself closer to veterans, you know, soldiers, and I belong to VVA, Vietnam Veterans of America. I belong to a chapter in Massachusetts, and I thought because of what I did was so different from what they did, that somehow I wasn't going to undergo the pains that many of them underwent. It wasn't true. I found myself, you know, bored, filled with anger. I found myself getting in lots of fist fights, which is something I never did in my whole life, but I was always getting into them, especially in traffic accidents.
Oh, so it wasn't fist fights over political things?
No, it was whether I was cut out or whatever. You know, it was really crazy behavior. And I realized that the war had filled me up with anger and violence, just like it had many soldiers, and there was no outlet for it, a reasonable outlet here.
Did you have recurring dreams? The kind of nightmares that many people report?
No, I never did. In fact, I did not. You know, I have very vivid memories. Sometimes I stand at a window and some of those children and their predicaments come back. But, you know, they're walking dreams that I have.
Was it then working with the children, trying to get these war-wounded children out of Vietnam? Was that, in a sense, what made the war so horrible for you?
Yeah, if you think about it, I had... maybe the worst job you could have. I dealt daily with children who were missing arms and legs, who were dying of protein loss because they had so many bullet holes in them and it was just leaking out of their bodies. Children who were burned by white phosphorus or napalm. Children who were scalped. Horrible things. So you don't easily shake those things off. I thought because I was doing something for them, that somehow I was free of the burden of having seen these things, but it's not true.
Do you know what happened to some of these children as they went back to Vietnam?
Well, I do. When I went back in 1989, I wanted to see some of them, just to see what it meant that we had done this, taken them out of their homes, repaired them to, you know, more or less successfully, and then sent them home again. And I got approval from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And that allowed me to go through this horrible network of people's committees, which run the show everywhere in Vietnam.
And that's bound to slow the process, isn't it?
But one by one, they allowed me, you know, finally, I got out of Saigon, and then I went to the provinces and then the districts, and then finally I was traveling by boat, by some motorized canoe up these little canals to villages where these children had ended up. it was just wonderful. I met this, for instance, that girl who was scalped. She's now 36 years old. She was about to be a grandmother. Her 18-year-old daughter was about to have a baby. She was a happy, healthy person living in what is serious straits of impoverishment, which afflicts all of Vietnam still, but a whole human being with a family. And I was so happy that we had done that. At the end of the visit, I was asking her, she had forgotten all her English, and I was asking, what did you remember? Who did you expect? And she didn't expect me, who was the person who had taken her out, but she had expected her foster parents from Boston. She was hoping it was them. And I asked her if there's anything she remembered about her stay in the U.S., and she said, just their kindness, that they treated me like their daughter. And then she did something amazing. She had this old wallet, and she took out this yellowed, creased letter. It was ancient, and she handed, opened it, unfolded it, and showed it to me. And I looked at it, and I had written it to her in 1968, and she'd been carrying it all those years, you know, 20 years, and I was really knocked out by that.
And this was the letter saying?
It was a letter. The woman, a Vietnamese woman who had come to Boston with her, had been killed in a drunk driving accident in Saigon, a drunk Arvin, South Vietnamese soldier, lost control of his truck and crushed her. She was on her motorcycle. This was a serious blow to this young woman because this older woman had taken into her own home and was teaching her how to read and write and how to sew. And so we worried a lot about her. And the letter simply said, try to live a life like Mary Cui. And
these were your words.
Yeah.
So she still has the letter as far as
you know?
She
still has the letter. I mean, the idea that we did have these subtle effects and good effects and did the right thing is a real nourishment as I grow older.
John Balaban's new memoir is titled Remembering Heaven's Face. He also has a new book of poetry called Words for My Daughter. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.